this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Music Review. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about music from such sources as the New York Times, the News and Observer, the Week Magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly. Music Review is designed to provide the latest coverage of classical folk, jazz, blues, rock, country, and pop music news. But first, these musical trivia questions. Today's musical trivia questions come to us from the website onthisday.com. Question number one. It was on this day back in 1979 that Little Richard, known for such hits as Good Golly, Miss Molly, Tutti Frutti, Lucille, and Whole Lotta Shakin' Goin' On, spoke at a revival meeting in North Richmond, California. What did he warn the congregation about? Was it A, the dangers of drugs, B, the consequences of not being kind to others, C, the need to show proper respect to women, or D, the evils of rock and roll music? 1979, Little Richard. Question number two, it was on this day in which year that the Billboard magazine published its very first listing of best-selling singles? Was it A, 1940, B, 1950, C, 1960, or D, 1970? The first listing of best-selling singles, which year was it? The answers to these two important musical trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program. Our transitions come to us from that same website, onthisday.com, and today, quote-unquote, is the weekend of July the 20th. Well, it was on this day back in 1933 that Katerina Jarboro became the first black prima donna of a U.S. opera company. She sang Aida at the Metropolitan Opera House in New York City. 1933. And it was 49 years ago today, 1969, that Duke Ellington and a portion of his band performed a 10-minute composition on ABC TV titled Moon Maiden. The event took place just one day after Neil Armstrong became the first man to set foot on the moon, 1969. Willie Nelson performing September Song introduces our country music news, an article written by Rich Cohen in AARP, the magazine, July 2018 issue, simply titled American Icon, Willie Nelson. For 60 years, the country music outlaw has set the bar for being true to yourself. At 85, he knows the secret to a life well lived. But will he tell us? Willie Nelson turned 85 in April, and though he still tours, drinks, vapes, and writes, and golfs, he's smart enough to know where he is. On the flip side, the back nine. It gives him freedom. He's down to essential things now, with time for only what he truly loves, like his wife and children, like his famous guitar, Trigger, the one with the hole worn through the top from strumming. Like St. Frank Sinatra in country music, Willie has taught us so much. How to be an honest outlaw, how to wear a bandana properly, how to listen, and how to be cool. Now, just one lesson remains, how to remain yourself while getting old. I don't think that my attitude has changed, he told me. I'm still doing what I want to do, and I suggest everybody do the same thing. I could try to sell you on the importance of Willie Nelson, but why? He notched his first hit as a songwriter in 1960 with a tune called Family Bible. In the decades that have followed, he has performed on 24 platinum or gold albums and composed dozens of pop and country hits, including timeless numbers such as On the Road Again, and he's got some others as well, to say the least, including Always on My Mind. He has appeared in more than 40 movies and headlined thousands of sold-out concerts. He smoked a joint on the White House roof in 1977, organized Farm Aid, the annual benefit for American family farmers, in 1985. He was at the center of a group of run-around country music pals with Waylon Jennings, Johnny Cash, and Kris Kristofferson, who played together as the Highwaymen. As one of two survivors of that crew, Willie stands as a last living link between Hank Williams, the Babe Ruth of Honky Tonk, and Blake Shelton, a country star of the moment. Of course, there have been hard times, for this is country music, drug busts, and failed marriages. These days, he seems more joyful than ever, as satisfied as any country singer who's lived past 30. His album count is well over 100, and his latest, Last Man Standing, features all new original songs. He's at work on a collection of Sinatra tunes, including My Way. But Willie does not like to talk about his achievements or place in history or how it will all be tallied up when he's gone. Sing about it, write about it, sure. The current live show includes Still Not Dead and Roll Me Up and Smoke Me When I Die. But discussing his legacy with a reporter is the worst kind of bad luck. He wants to talk about his life instead. He grew up in Abbott, Texas, a blink-and-you'll-miss-it spot 70 miles outside Dallas. They say the population never changes, he told me. Every time a baby's born, a man leaves town. Comfort came from the radio, old-time music wending through a Texas night. It suggested another kind of existence. At some point, Willie picked up a guitar. I started when I was 5 or 6, he told me. I had one of those old Sears and Roebuck guitars with the strings high off the neck. Your fingers literally would bleed. When they healed up, though, they were pretty tough. He was soon singing and playing at churches and in town halls, his sister hammering away at his side. Other things happened. He joined the Air Force, worked as a door-to-door vacuum and encyclopedia salesman, and as a disc jockey, and wrote. Those first songs came under the influence of country legends, all those great Western swing bands. Willie debuted songs that would become career-defining hits for other artists, Hello Walls, Nightlife, Funny How Time Slips Away. One night he played a demo for Charlie Dick, a manager who happened to be married to Patsy Cline. Dick took Willie home, woke Cline, and made Willie play her the demo tape. It was called Crazy, and it went top 10 for Cline in 1961. Released before she died, it's forever associated with the sadly beautiful mood of that short life. I've listened to Willie Nelson all my life, but fell in love with him in 1992. One night, I happened to play his version of Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain on the jukebox, a Fred Rose song. It's unspeakably sad, the story of a man mourning his wife and looking forward to meeting her in the next world, and carries echoes of the oldest American music. Willie recorded it in 1975 for Redheaded Stranger, one of his first million-selling albums. It was among the breakthrough songs that took Willie from Nashville 1960 into the 1970s and beyond. He found his mature style on that song, realized that he could sing anything and make it new. When you are 22 and lonely and far from home, you feel sorry for yourself in a way that is the essence of country music. His voice was humorous and sad and full of wisdom. I knew he'd understand everything. If I ever did get to meet Willie Nelson, I promised myself I'd ask him the secret of life. The article skips down and ends with this, because he eventually did meet Willie, and he told him what Blue Eyes Crying in the Rain had meant to him when he was 22. He nodded like he already knew. Then, before he could slip away, I asked him the secret of life. It's simple, Willie said. Do what you want to do, If I don't want to do it, forget it. But if I do want to do it, get out of my way. And in classical music news, we have this article entitled, These Bizarre Instruments Play a Symphony That Only Aliens Can Hear. This is written by Aili Anzioti from FastCompany.com on the 14th of July, 2018. To a human audience, they sound like nothing, but that doesn't mean the latest project from experimental philosopher Jonathan Keats doesn't send a message. In April, the music department at the University of North Carolina, Asheville, hosted an end-of-the-year orchestral performance. While the stage was filled with instruments, not all of them could be heard by the human audience. For experimental philosopher Jonathan Keats, who composed the performance in conjunction with UNCA music students and faculty, that inaudibility was the point. The composition was not just designed for a human audience. It was intended to reach any life form in the universe that might have been listening. We can't assume that beings elsewhere in the universe are like us in any way whatsoever, including at the biological level of having sensory organs that are like ours, Keats says. His orchestra translates the fundamental principles of music and sound to a format that other beings in the universe could perhaps respond to. To Keats, this effort represents a long-overdue revolution for the realms of arts and culture, something he has been pushing for in his work for years. Once Copernicus proved that the Earth is not the center of the universe, and one small player in a much larger solar system and network of galaxies, further discoveries abounded, Keats says. But the arts remain all about Earth, and all about the idea of, quote-unquote, me. So I thought if the arts were able to undergo a Copernican revolution and abandon their geocentric way of thinking, they could tap into something really profound. With his orchestra, he pared the concept of music down to its most basic form in order to achieve a greater universality. If you think about what sound is, it's the modulation of amplitude and frequency over time, Keats says. That's what happens in Beethoven's Ninth Symphony. That's what happens when Taylor Swift sings. The Universal Instrumental and Instruments, collected under the name Intergalactic Omniponics, he and his students at UNCA created, produce waves and disruptions, as traditional instruments like violins do. They're just not the type of waves that humans can necessarily register. For instance, there's an ultrasonic organ which Keats created by organizing a collection of dog whistles. He also developed a pair of bells that utilize gamma rays, which reach frequencies far beyond the human sensory range. And lastly, Keats devised a cello-like instrument that creates gravitational waves via the swinging of a metal ball bearing. All of the instruments will be on display at the Modernism Gallery in San Francisco beginning July 24, and visitors will be able to experience what it's like to play music for someone other than themselves or the other visible beings in the room. While visitors to the showroom won't receive the full orchestral experience of the initial performance in Asheville, North Carolina, they will perhaps come away with an idea of how to play an instrument they can't hear and why it's important to do so. Keats hopes to nudge people who listen to the orchestra or interact with the instruments to step outside their own experience and consider the value of creating not just for themselves, but for a greater audience. Humility is one quality that comes out of this, he says. Right now, he adds, our society is so incredibly arrogant. But this type of universal music creates a greater sensitivity to others and others' experiences, and a greater sense of the full gamut of experience, and an awareness of what we don't know. This review of John Coltrane's Both Directions at Once, The Lost Album, is published in The Week magazine July 20, 2018, and it's given 3 out of a possible 4 stars, and it opens our jazz music news for today. Impulse Records' new John Coltrane album arrives with the excitement of a rare celestial event, says Nate Chinian in NPR.org. Captured on a single day in 1963 and previously unreleased, the studio recordings find the jazz legend and his classic quartet nearing an imposing creative peak. Having just released Ballads, Coltrane was still balancing the demand for commercial success with his yearning for sonic exploration, feeling his way toward 1965's A Love Supreme. Of the 7 tracks here, some repeated as alternate takes, 2 untitled originals will be unfamiliar to even the most serious traineologist. The set's highlight is Slow Blues, an 11-minute piece distinguished by an abrupt cascades and keening high notes of Coltrane solos, said Richard Brody in The New Yorker. Elsewhere, the spiritual temperature of the music is lower than on most of the quartet's 1962-63 live recordings, long available as bootlegs. Even so, this is illuminating stuff. Any serious fan wouldn't want to be without it. And this has been Coltrane and Ellington performing in a sentimental mood in the background right now.
Let me down before. Mm-hmm. Don't imagine you're too familiar, and I don't see you anymore.
Billy Joel performing Just the Way You Are opens our rock and pop music news. It's an article entitled The Unlikely Rock Star. It's written by Dotson Radar and published in Parade magazine, July 15, 2018. Billy Joel opens up about music, the women in his life, superstardom, his struggles with alcohol, and why he feels like a very lucky man. On July 18th, Billy Joel will leave his estate on Long Island's North Shore to take a 15-minute helicopter ride to Manhattan for what will be his 100th career performance at Madison Square Garden. For the last 4 years, the Piano Man has been in residence at the iconic 20,000-plus seat arena, each month performing sold-out shows to adoring audiences. And later this year, on September 7th, at Chicago's Wrigley Field, and September 21 at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, Missouri, he will cap off his concert tour of Major League Baseball stadiums across the nation. Since joining his first band in 1964, Joel has sold more than 150 million albums, toured the globe, and become a rock legend and one of the richest entertainers in the world. I'm a very lucky man, he says. He also has triumph over very difficult odds. As a Jewish boy, he was haunted by the deaths of his father's family in the Holocaust. But through it all, he wrote and released hits like The Stranger, Just the Way You Are, which is playing in the background now. It's still rock and roll to me, New York State of Mind, Uptown Girl, and the song that came to be his calling card, Piano Man.
I said I love you, that's forever, this I promise from
Parade visited Joel at his motorcycle gallery, 20th Century Cycles, in Oyster Bay, a hamlet on a harbor of the Long Island Sound. Joel, 69, lives a few minutes away with his fourth wife and their two daughters. Joel has another daughter, now 32, from his nine-year marriage to model Christy Brinkley, his second wife. Sitting at a table in the gallery, Joel basks momentarily in a breeze that wafts through an open door, lights a cigar, and smiles. How many motorcycles do you own? There's about 100. They're a lot cheaper than cars, and they're fun to mess with. You love boats, too. Yeah, I grew up around 15 miles from here in the middle of Long Island. As a little kid, I always liked boats and the romance of living on an island. Was your childhood difficult? My mom had a tough time struggling to make ends meet. Women who had to work weren't treated very nicely. There were no good-paying jobs for women then. Your dad was a classical pianist. Why didn't you go into classical music? I did play classical music for the first 12 years that I took lessons. I got pretty good, but I didn't have the ambition to be a concert pianist. I knew I wasn't going to be Beethoven. I wanted to write my own music. When did you start writing your own songs? Well, around 1964, I started writing ersatz Beatle tunes. Why the Beatles? They weren't pretty boys like Fabian and Frankie Avalon. They looked like working-class guys from Liverpool. They weren't Pat Boone pushing a religious agenda. I remember the look on their faces on the Ed Sullivan Show. They were kidding around, having fun, like they couldn't believe their luck. They wrote their own music. They played their own instruments. The Beatles put it all together. Why do crowds keep coming? I'm an unlucky candidate for a rock star. I don't look like a rock star. I'm like the eternal underdog. In my lyrics, there's a lot of acknowledgement that I'm a screw-up. I'm human. I'm as lost as you are. I'm just trying to find my way. I guess people like that. The Embers present today's local music news. We have an upcoming concert this Saturday, July 21st at 7:30 p.m. in the Booth Amphitheater, Cary, North Carolina. The annual Beach Party with North Tower Band. This is Summerfest 2018. NorthCarolinaSymphony.org or phone 919-733-2750 for more information and tickets. This Summerfest tradition begins the legendary North Tower Band to the stage to make the whole family smile, sing along, and dance until the stars come out. The North Carolina Symphony presents these guest artists and will not perform at this concert.
Beach music. I love beach music, 'cause I was born with it in my bones.
So how'd you do on today's musical trivia questions? Well, the answer to our first question, it was on this day back in 1979 that Little Richard, known for such hits as Good Golly, Miss Molly, Tutti Frutti, Lucille, and Whole Lot of Shaking Going On, spoke at a revival meeting in North Richmond, California. What did he warn the congregation about? Was it A, the dangers of drugs? Was it B, the consequences of not being kind to others? Was it C, the need to show proper respect to women? Or was it D, the evils of rock and roll music? Little Richard, known as Reverend Richard Penniman, warned the congregation about the evils of rock and roll music. Correct answer, therefore, answer D. And the answer to our second question. It was on this day in which year that Billboard magazine published its very first listing of best-selling singles. Was that 1940, 1950, 1960, or 1970? Correct answer? Answer A, 1940. As noted in Billboard magazine from the 27th of July, 2017, in an article titled, Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra Ushered in the Landmark Ranking. In July of 1940, Billboard published its first chart ranking, The Sales of Recorded Songs, which paved the way for seven decades and counting of Billboard's hallmark tracking of music popularity. In 1956, the Billboard's 200 would begin showcasing the top-selling weekly albums. The premise introduced in July of 1940 of ranking the best-selling songs in the U.S. would expand to include a radio airplay component, spurring the death of the Billboard Hot 100 as the premier national songs chart in the August 4, 1958 issue. Prior to July 1940, Billboard had highlighted the national sheet music bestsellers, records most popular on music machines, and songs with the most radio plugs on a handful of New York radio stations. The national list of best-selling retail records, however, was the first to poll retailers nationwide on record sales. The new chart was billed as a trade service feature based on the 10 best-selling records of the past week at a selection of national retailers from New York to Los Angeles. Tommy Dorsey crowned the inaugural retail list with I'll Never Smile Again. The eventual standard featured vocals by Frank Sinatra would total 12 weeks at the summit. Not only did Dorsey top the first Billboard song sales chart, but the band leader also placed at number 8. His older brother Jimmy Dorsey ranked at number 2, and Glenn Miller claimed 3 of the first tally's top 10. So let's close out today's program with that 1940 recording by Tommy Dorsey and Frank Sinatra, I'll Never Smile Again.
Smile at you. I'll never laugh again.
What good would it do?
Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Music Review. And as we leave you, remember these words. Kindness is a language which blind people see and deaf people hear. Be sure to tune in at the same time next week. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Content of this program intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Music Review, readily available as a podcast after the broadcast in the TRRS website, TriangleReadingService.org. Now, if you have a suggestion for music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson at 919-832-5138. So long, until next time.